plate a potential nugget.
Moving to how some of these organizations empower professional CEOs, Tarun, one of the themes I was reflecting on was, at some level, these entrepreneurs are playing the long game, the infinite game, if you will. And professionals often come in, and the duration of, I wonder if principal agency problem is the right way to frame this, but they often solve for a different duration. So any observations you have about how, you know, entrepreneurs strike that balance of solving for the long term while getting short term leadership?
First of all, I would say that generally they don't do it well. Even these iconic entrepreneurs, my general observation is that it's pretty hard to do. And it's understandable because, a hotshot professional who is not part of a family kind of have this feeling that his or her upside is capped. And maybe to some extent you can compensate by monetary upside, if not titular upside or ability to move up the hierarchy. So that is an issue. It's a general issue. And so when you think about how the vast majority of these organizations that are profiled here, particularly the for-profits, not the not-for-profits, but particularly the for-profits, are family-run enterprises or family-controlled enterprises, that's a downside of family ownership, right? That it's not unfettered access to the markets for talent, because a lot of talented people would not want to work in there since they know ex ante that their upside is capped. And so that has to be counterbalanced with the pros of the family enterprise, which is continuity, playing the long game, transmission of values, what have you. And it's an empirical question which side dominates. The pros dominate the cons. But I think the way you said it is correct. There is a principal agent problem. The family is the principal and the agent is the professional. And like in any principal agent problem, there are incentive issues that have to be dealt with in the neoclassical model of economics, you would deal with it with contracts. So you would have a formal, employment contract with compensation clauses and so on. That process of, creating contracts to manage the principal agent problem is perhaps most refined in the United States of all economies. And, I sit on a number of boards in the U.S. and including on sometimes in the compensation committee, and you spend a lot of time designing these contracts. I'm just mentioning this because none of that exists in most of these developing countries. In most of the developing countries, a contract is more of an implicit one. Of course, there's an agreement on salary and bonus, but that's pretty simple. That's a simple contract. For the most part, it's trust between the head of the company, typically a family member, or the board, and the hired professional. And of course, a contract like that only lasts as long as it's mutually beneficial. But you find that the implicit contract that is implied by the values are a far more effective way to retain good managers and good professionals than any attempt to micromanage compensation details. In the US, you see a lot of micromanagement of compensation details. There's endless amount of time spent. There are compensation consultants, there are surveys, people are making sure that the board is at the 60th percentile for this size and this industry, and the CEO is not above the 75th and not below the 45th, and it's just nuts.
Actually, moving to an adjacent theme, Tarun, we'd interacted when I was at Egon Zehnder with a South Indian-based, you were on the board of a South Indian-based company, and we were looking for a leader. I was curious if you found any patterns in the kind of people, the kind of professionals that flourish in a business family. Are there one or two strands that stand out for you, for the professional?
In India, I would say, until recently, until maybe 10 years ago, to pick a number, I would say there was something that distinguished it. The people who worked in family-run enterprises tended to be more willing to play a comparable long game, at least over the arc of their careers. Mm-hmm. And that somehow seemed more suited to family-run enterprises, which had this long time horizon attribute to them. But lately, I would say I can't see any pattern, because now even the family enterprises are getting more and more dynamic and modern and competing for the same talent pool with standalone de novo ventures, if you will, not those that have been inherited from a previous generation. So it's hard to say, Deepak. I don't know what distinguishes them. I would say it's not really the family dimension per se, other than the fact that we talked about earlier, which is that the family enterprise has a natural cap on how far you can go, just by definition.
The point Tarun makes about the principal agency problem is true not just in the way entrepreneurs pick CEOs, but I find that it's also true in the way they engage with various advisors. To the extent they can take a journey view and enroll a few advisors who can walk the long game with them, I feel the better aligned the incentives are and better mutual value that's created in these situations. I'm reminded of a conversation with Sukhinder Singh Cassidy, who was the head of Google in Asia Pacific in the past and has also written the book Choose Possibility. She speaks about the benefits of working with a coach for over a decade.
If you give up on having a coach, let's say at year two, they haven't seen your cycles to reflect back to you. Number two, he has been a constant who's been with me through multiple management teams. He's somebody I can bring in who both has my history, but can help new people get to know me and navigate me, help me navigate them. So I've actually used him even as somebody to get my 360 feedback from, because my management teams know that I trust him. They know that they know that maybe if they want to give me feedback and they're too afraid to give it to me, you know, face to face, which sometimes leadership teams are, it doesn't matter how much you ask for it. They know that I'm providing them a conduit for somebody I trust who can hold their feedback and give it to me. So that history has a lot of value, right? You know, it helps with pattern recognition. So I'd say one of the biggest values has been, like, it's one of my longest standing relationships beside my marriage. And it's somebody who can reflect back to me what I said 5 years ago, what can stitch together my own feelings of myself with, like, when I use him to get peer feedback or 360 feedback, he can stitch together other people's views of me and help give me a holistic perspective. And I know, and I think at the end of the day, this is the value of coaches. We know that, yes, we may be paying them, but their job is to help us be our best selves with no skin in the game other than our success. No politics other than, you know, it's just like a very pure relationship. And so I appreciate that. Like, I appreciate having somebody in my corner with whom I can be completely authentic, who has no other vested interest other than my success. And who I also trust to give me feedback, right? Like, I trust they have my goodest, best intention. So I think it's a conduit for us as leaders. I think that a great coach is a conduit for us to learn about ourselves, probe ourselves, challenge ourselves. And that's why I like the history and tenure in that relationship. That has had given me disproportionate value.
Personally speaking, as a practicing coach, if I've engaged with a leader for a while, the cumulative context is immensely valuable in my ability to be of value to that leader and the organization. If you're building a business to last, I guess the mindset with which you engage with agents is crucial, whether it's a CEO, a management consultant, a banker, lawyer, or an executive coach. Thank you for listening.